I'm Danny Wallace, and I've been writing about men for years.
I'm Phil Hilton, and I've been working in men's magazines for decades.
And this is Menatomy.
Oh, I'm alcoholic, mate. I was a complete pisshead. I think I did it to numb out feelings I've had since childhood. And people go, whoa, okay, like that.
I'd use the adrenaline to basically ask almost impossible things of my body, which I wouldn't be able to do now.
But even when I'm at my smallest, like I am right now, which is nice, I'm still the biggest person in the room.
Obviously, the longer they take, the better the job they do. And if you don't look too closely, as the camera flies over your head, it looks like you've got a full head of hair.
Hello and welcome to episode 52 of Menatomy, an entire year of body talk, Phil.
Oh, it's been a journey. So many tales of... I find myself becoming one of those people that goes, oh, this reminds me of something on this podcast I do with Danny Wallace at dinner parties after two glasses of wine. And I see my lucky friends and relatives just slightly switch off because I'm just full of this stuff. There's been so many brilliant stories on here.
Yeah, we've learnt a heck of a lot. I'm not sure I was expecting to learn quite so much. This all kind of started because we were trying to come up with, you know, an idea for the worst podcast possible to be asked on. And we decided between it was kind of like it would be one where you have to talk about your body, like terrifying. And yet, almost everybody we've asked has gone, yeah, all right, and then turned up and done it. Which is absolutely extraordinary. So, you know, our thanks to all our very many guests. There'll be a chance to hear a few of them at the end of today's show after we have talked to our guest. But first, Phil Hilton, what did you want to say?
I want to talk about the Love Island, the general summer reality shows and the sense of there being impossibly amazing bodies on display on TV all the time now, and the kind of pressure this is putting on younger blokes. I'm really into fitness. I'm really into working out. I don't look anything like any of those people. I never did. And it's a weird sense of like I'm failing because I don't look like them for some people. And it's something to chat about and kind of go, let's all let each other off. Looking anything like that. I admire the work, but let's all just chill out and relax and not worry about that stuff, don't you think?
There seems to be a growing kind of a growing sort of reaction to that. I think we talked about it a little bit last week. You mentioned an article that you'd read about a guy going, let's stop now, this is getting crazy, just, you know, chill. And there was another survey this week, I think, that said that a third of men have real issues with their bodies approaching summer. It always used to be obviously that, you know, that was kind of hidden. It would be the big adverts that they'd put up in London with a woman in a bikini saying, are you beach body ready? And that led to kickback from a lot of people saying, don't put this pressure on women. And I think now a lot of men are going, can we not have it either, please? Because a third of men, you know, that's a lot.
Yeah, we've had supermodels on here. We've had strong men on here. And the big lesson for me of the Menatomy podcast is everyone has their issues. Everyone's got something they're not happy with. And what a brilliant signal to put out to men who usually like to keep a brave face on everything, going, there's nothing to see here. I'm fine. And actually, we've created a space where people can talk about it more honestly.
And, you know, some of those issues go back years and years, and some are brand new, which kind of neatly segues us into our guest this week, who for the past 20 years has been on British TV most days as the host of Homes Under the Hammer, and his remarkable appearances on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, and indeed when he was forced to bear all, said he would bear all in order to raise awareness for a very special charity on ITV's The Real Full Monty. He's also a man who just recently, suffered a real health scare, a kind of a shock to the system that's really made him reevaluate everything. Something he just did not see coming, but arrived nonetheless. We'll let him tell that story for himself. And just to warn you, we managed to catch this gentleman as he'd just finished filming and he was in the middle of town. And it's the first time we've essentially done a podcast with someone who was kind of shouting his stories in the middle of a street and may have looked odd to anyone passing by. There's a little bit of microphone popping. We sort it out. It's all good. But please welcome the magnificent Martin Roberts. Martin Roberts, thank you so much for joining us on Manatomy today.
Oh gosh, Danny, it's a pleasure.
It's great. It's great that you would do this. I know you're out and about at the moment, always filming. Is it? It's nearly 20 years, isn't it, of Homes Under the Hammer?
You believe it or not, I've been doing Homes Under the Hammer for 20 years. You know, and I know that we have a relationship that goes back a long way, Danny, because yeah. I know that I won't take partial claim to fame, but one of my biggest claims to fame, I'll be honest, is that you actually cited Holmes Under the Hammer as the thing that made you realize you were losing your mind and needed to get alive.
Oh, that's one way of putting it. That's one way of putting it. But
no, seriously, people might not know. Didn't it lead to you sort of coming up with the idea for Yes Man? Because you thought, you know, here I am watching daytime television. I've got to get out more. And that led to Yes Man. And that led to all those wonderful things that happened to you as a result.
I will always be grateful for the world of Homes Under the Hammer and the work of Martin Roberts. Thank you. And thank you for joining us on Manatomy. It's where we investigate the body in a fun way. So for anyone who can't see you right now, can you describe yourself physically as you join us today?
So I am, to my own horror, 58 years old. And I have to say, when I look around other 58-year-olds, I don't think I'm doing too bad. I don't do the eating of weeds, and I don't do the running around like a crazy thing. And I guess it programmed me as a child when my dad had a badge which said, I have a limited number of heartbeats and I'm not going to waste any of them on doing exercise. And whether or not that sort of went into my psyche or not, but I am not very good. I do walk the dogs and stuff, but I don't really do the whole gym thing. I start it and I try the whole leaning over weird on balls, and I went to yoga until I farted in the middle of the class and all that kind of stuff. And I just thought this is no. So I'd sort of say I look after myself health and vitamin wise, but I don't. I drink too much, and I don't do enough exercise, and you know, all those kind of things. So, but I don't think you'd look at me and necessarily go nearly 60. So maybe I'm doing something right, Danny. I don't know.
I think you're absolutely right, and it's interesting. I mean, you mentioned the heartbeats there, which kind of, I mean, we can dive straight in with what happened recently, because it sounded, from everything I read, pretty terrifying. You'd been feeling bad over the Easter weekend, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I've had asthma since childhood, so I kind of got used to this feeling of a tightness in the chest. And, you know, for the previous weeks leading up to the Easter holidays, I'd been noticing, you know, just really having difficulty breathing. And at night, I'd wake up and I was really struggling for breath, and my inhaler wasn't really working. And it just got more and more. And I did that terrible thing, Danny. I did play Google Doctor. So I went onto Google. I put in my symptoms. It was shortness of breath. It was pains in the chest. It was various other bits and pieces. And it was absolutely tick box for long COVID. So I thought, you know what? At some point, I've caught COVID. I haven't realized I've got it. And I've ended up with long COVID. And so I almost didn't push an alarm bell. And then it just got worse and worse and worse, where I could hardly walk. And I was planning my days around not going upstairs and downstairs more than once, because I literally physically couldn't do it. And yet still, you're in that mindset that you're just going to get on. And somehow you accept something which, looking back, was totally unacceptable. And I should have done something about it a lot sooner. But in the end, as you say, over the Easter weekend, at the end of the Easter weekend, because I thought, well, I'm not going to trouble the hospitals over Easter. You know, I've got to do something. So I got my wife to take me into A&E. And by this point, I could hardly put one step, you know, one foot in front of another without sort of stopping and being out of breath. And I went into A&E. And, you know, like a lot of people at the moment, you think, oh, you don't want to trouble the hospitals. And how long am I going to have to wait? And sure enough, there was a sign there that said, you know, 3 to 4 hour wait. And I reckon I was seen in about 45 seconds, because I said, you know, I'm out of breath, I've got chest pains, and that sort of sets off quite a lot of alarm bells. So I was taken into the triage, and the nurses look at you, and pretty soon, by this point, I was delirious. I was, you know, I was at home just before we left, and I was noticing that I was writing B's as D's, and so, you know, something was going on. And it turns out the reason for that is that my heart was effectively being strangled by this sac around it called the pericardium, and the pericardium, for whatever reason, had become full of fluid. So if you imagine the heart being inside a bottle, and then you fill, you know, a balloon that's around it, you fill the bottle with more and more water, it pushes and pushes on the balloon, and that was squeezing the heart. So by the time an increasingly senior number of doctors and consultants got to see me, my heart rate was plummeting. My blood pressure was down to 60 over 30. My lungs and my heart and my liver and my kidneys were down to 30% of their normal. And I could have died at any second, because at some point the heart goes, sod this for a bunch of soldiers, and it just stops. And there's no amount of massage. There's no amount of electro, you know, shocking. There's no amount of, you know, worried people going, we've got to do something, doctor, is going to make any difference. And you are basically it. And the only time in history previously, you know, that they would have diagnosed this would have been, you know, as a post-mortem. And they would have gone, oh, yeah, inflamed heart. But luckily, some doctors were very smart. They did an echo sound scan. And took some x-rays of the heart, which I've since seen. And, you know, this heart, which should have been the size of a grapefruit, the sac around it had grown to about three times that. And so it was, you know, it was all a bit of a blur from that point on. But 2 hours, 3 hours later, I was in a very specialist operating theatre having a tube into the sac around my heart. And they drew off a litre and a half of fluid. And at that point, the heart is then able to pump, because what was happening is, if you imagine the heart being constricted by this built-up fluid around it, you take that fluid away, and then the heart is able then to pump, and, you know, things started getting back to normal. But up until that point, it, you know, as I was being pushed around the hospital by the hospital porter, it wasn't a porter, it was a cardiac surgeon, and he had like a Ghostbusters backpack on, presumably with whatever it is they could have given me had I died at any minute, which I could have died at any minute. And, you know, you imagine what that's sort of been since like, you know, it's like, oh, wow, that was the closest I've ever come to not being here anymore.
Can I ask what you were thinking as this picture unfolded in front of you, Martin?
You know, you just put yourself in the hands of the professionals. You are... It's an out-of-body experience. Bear in mind that my brain was being starved of an adequate amount of oxygen. And the scary thing is, and I think this is something I want to get over to people, is two things. One, it was a red herring of a diagnosis, because I was having difficulty breathing. Now, to you and me, and to an untrained person, you think that's something to do with your lungs because you can't breathe properly. But in fact, it was the fact the heart was not able to function properly. It wasn't getting enough blood, oxygen around the bloody body. Therefore, it was calling on the heart, the lungs to do more. Lungs were saying, I can't do any more. So it's coming over as short as a breath. And so it goes on. And interestingly enough, I talked to a doctor since, and it's a very rare condition that I had. It's called a pericardial effusion, which led to something called a tapenade, which is this really critical thing. And I said, how often do you do operations for that? He said, we do about 10 a year. And then I spoke to another doctor who said, and that's the major hospital in Bath that did it, the RUH, the Royal United Hospital, did an amazing job. I spoke to another doctor who said they actually set the symptoms for what I had as like a trick question in medical exams. Oof. Because it is so easily disguised as other things that it takes a real clever bit of analysis to go, you know what? It's actually a heart problem, and it's actually going to be the pericardium swelling, because this is happening, and these are the key factors. So it's a really difficult thing to spot. So I was really lucky that I had an amazing team who just went, hang on a minute, let's just do an echogram. Oh, yeah, that's interesting. But, you know, you look back, and it's all scary stuff. You go, oh, my God, how things could have been different. I've got two young kids, and, you know, I've got life ahead of me, and blah-de-blah, and it could have all just ended.
It's extraordinary, isn't it, just the bluntness of that as well, of just realising that... as you say, you could have had minutes to live. I mean, that must keep you awake at night.
You know what? I try to focus on the fact that I'm still here, mm-hmm. and I view every day as a bonus, which does bring its challenges because, you know, I do feel really lucky. I feel lucky rather than unlucky. I mean, it was an extremely rare thing that I got, and they still don't know what caused it. It was possibly just a viral infection, but I got it, but I was seen and I survived, and I'm a great believer in fate and spirits and all that kind of stuff. So I thank them for keeping me on the planet. It does put things in a different perspective. I find myself very short-tempered with pettiness. It's like I nearly bloody died. I can't say that, but it doesn't work. Like I was in Lidl, right? You know, you have those plastic carts that you put your foot shopping in. So if you've ever tried to take a plastic cart out of Lidl, it sets off alarms. So I had a shopping basket full of stuff in Lidl, right? And I headed out of Lidl to take this basket of stuff in my slightly still ill state, having just had this major heart operation, to take this basket of heavy things to the car, and it set up the alarms, and the security guard came over and said, "You can't take that outside." I'm going, "Mate, I'm taking it outside." He goes, "You can't take it outside, it's against the rules." I went, "I nearly bleeding well died, you silly ass. All I'm doing is taking this fucking thing outside. I'm only taking the plastic fucking thing out to my fucking car, you stupid piece of ass." But you can't actually say that, because you're on telly and people would actually have a go and somebody would probably actually film it. So I actually went, that seems like a bit of a silly rule. So I'm taking it out to my car anyway. So you do find that, you know, you do have less tolerance for pettiness. And there's a lot of people where I am at the moment looking at me in a very strange way, by the way.
I imagine they would be.
Next on Manatomy.
Don't think that the medical profession are going to poo you for going there and wasting their time. They're there to save lives, and they'd rather have you go there and turn you away saying you're fine than have you die.
It's. I mean, you have a sort of an evolving relationship with your body in many ways. This recent episode kind of redefining your relationship with it. I know that you've spoken in the past of as a child you were sort of picked on a bit, which has informed probably. You know, you have a lot of empathy, and it was probably informed, you know, by that. But you were kind of picked on as a kid for your physicality, weren't you?
So I've always had a problem with my weight. So when I was a child, certainly up until sort of 15 or so, I was fat. I was definitely overweight. I mean, my nickname at school was Yogurt, low fat, and it harsh but fair, to be fair. But you know, it does mean that you are constantly paranoid about your weight, and I am, and I do have yo-yo weight, so it goes up and it goes down, and you know, I put on weight and then I lose it, and I always think, oh, I feel much better now I've lost weight, and then you know, you have too many people. Pizzas and tiny bottles of wine, and it puts all on again, and da di da. But that whole being bullied at school thing—that definitely forms you as a person. And again, it does mean that, you know, you certainly are slightly less tolerant of people who are like that. It does make you more sensitive to your weight than I guess others, but. But I, on the other hand, I like my food too much to be paranoid about it.
How is it being in front of the camera for decades? And do people give you feedback on your weight and stuff?
Interesting that. Yeah, I mean, I give myself probably a harder time than other people. And you know, I'm not super svelte, and I'm not like a Love Islander, am I? You know, I did the Full Monty,
which was incredibly. Year. I mean, I would never, you know, I would be so scared of that.
I mean, and I said, you know, I'll do this, but please, God, don't put me in with a load of Chippendales. And, you know, they introduced the people. And first of all, there was Teddy from Love Island. And then there was Colin Jackson, the Olympic hurdler. And then there was James Jordan, the professional dancer. And then there was a guy, a Duncan from Blue. And I looked at all these svelte bodies, and I had a meltdown. And I was like, are you having a laugh? Am I the joke here? am I the whipping boy of you know, am I the sort of the token fat bloke who's just been here, brought in? So it was really hard, and that definitely was a difficult thing for me, because, you know, I wish I had one of those bodies, but then again, I'm also pragmatic about it. Is I know how to get one of those bodies. You just have to work really hard at it, and I admire anybody who spends so much time in the gym or looks after their weight, you know, and what they eat. I really admire it, you know, but... you know, I unfortunately don't commit to it to as I should, and I'm sure if I did, I'd feel a lot better, but I don't.
Yeah, I couldn't do that.
I love working out, actually. I'm exactly your age, Martin, and but I understand that the culture of it all, and especially with all the influencers and stuff, can be extremely off-putting and alienating.
Yeah, I think one of these things, isn't it? Once you're into it, and I got a personal trainer before I did Full Monty, and that actually worked really well for me. Somebody who motivated me and came along and said, okay, well, you know, you're not going to be Arnold Schwarzenegger, but let's get you doing a little bit of this. And I definitely felt a lot better. So, you know, it's something which, you know, I should take my health more seriously is the reality. I really, really should commit to it. And I keep on saying I should, a bit like I'm saying I should play the piano more, you know, and I, you know, da-di-da-di-da-di-da. But I really, you know, let me commit right now. I'm going to do it more. Well, I like I am lying. You know,
he didn't even give the lie any time to settle. We're going to get a bit more airtime.
It took. I mean, what guts it took, though. You know, to agree to a TV show like that, and to know what the, you know, result is going to be. You're going to have to go through with it.
Yeah, I know.
And
I
it's
know.
It's it very very brave.
I did it to raise awareness for bowel cancer, because my best mate, who was the same age as me, who was super strong, super, you know, fit, everything, he died at the age of 54 of bowel cancer, you know, which is super shocking. You know, and he's a classic bloke. He didn't go to the doctor in time. He didn't do all those things that he should. You know, and so it was to raise awareness of men getting themselves, a bit like this, you know, this whole thing about I shout and scream about what happened to me in terms of my heart. Just get to the doctors, get to A&E. You know, the moment I think we all ignore our bodies more than we should in terms of it. When it tells you something's wrong, you know, I knew something wasn't wrong. I thought Google knew better than my body, and it didn't. And like my mate, you know, he just ignored the fact that he had blood in his poo, and, you know, and it went on. He thought, I've got hemorrhoids or whatever, you know, and he didn't get himself to the doctor in time. And by the time he got there, the cancer had spread, you know, and for me, I didn't get to the A&E as quick as I could. And I was within a few hours of dying. So there's a running theme here, which is, as soon as it starts feeling wrong, you've got to do something about it, you know, and just don't think that the medical profession are going to poo-poo you for going there and wasting their time. They're there to save lives, and they'd rather have you go there and turn you away saying you're fine than have you die.
Yeah. And this, of course, this was your best friend, wasn't it, Dave, who you were so close to, and it really had a profound impact on you, didn't it?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, as I said, it affects my, you know, I said intolerance of pettiness, but also you do want every day to be super special. You know, I want to have a Serengeti sunset every day, you know, which when you're picking up the kids from school and going to Tesco's is not that easy. So that is my biggest mental challenge. I want every day to be super special. Yeah. And when it isn't, I'm disappointed, because, you know, this is a bonus, because I couldn't have had necessarily this day in July. You know, this, I couldn't have had another birthday. I possibly couldn't have seen, you know, my kids having another Christmas or doing their exams or passing their tests or having their first girlfriend or boyfriend or going through school or getting married. You know, all that was dead. All this effort we put into surviving and building our little, you know, our houses and our homes and our life and our careers ended, holy mackerel, on a Tuesday. You know, in March, what, you know, so there is a lot of mental stuff that you have to deal with, and certainly wanting things to be magical from now on is a dream and a wish, but it's not that easy on a day-to-day basis, but I'm doing my best.
Yeah. And Phil wanted to mention something that we find so impressive as well, you know, the books, Phil.
Yeah, your book Sadsville, I was really impressed by, do you want to explain what it is first of all?
So I wrote a series of children's books called The Vills, which are sort of these wacky lands where something's gone a bit wrong. In Windyville, it's always windy, and in Colesville, it's always cold, and in Boardsville, everyone's always bored. And I've already had a close association with the NSPCC, and I decided to write a children's mental well-being book, Sadsville, where everyone's sad for a silly reason. The man who's making the local crisps in the local crisp factory is putting real onions in the cheese union. And crisps, everyone's crying. But you only find that as a process of going through the book. And the idea is that in this land, everyone can't work out why everyone's sad, but they are. But they decide not to change things until an outsider comes in and sees that, you know, this shouldn't be like this. And it is just to encourage children to think outside the box about their own emotions, and also recognise that sometimes we are sad. You know, that sadness can actually be okay sometimes. You know, our football team loses. You know, our holiday ends. That's sad. But there's a big difference between that kind of sad and sort of you're being bullied, you're being abused, that, you know, that kind of sadness, which is we call bad sad, as opposed to the other sadness, which is good sad. Well, it's not good, but you know what I mean. Yeah. And so we managed to get a copy of this book along with a teaching guide and information out to a free copy to every single primary school in the UK, because it's sort of aimed at 7 and 8 year olds when they're just starting to get handle on their emotions. And yeah, it's called Sadsville, and I've got a foundation called the Martin Roberts Foundation, and that just works, you know, on children's mental well-being, which of course has taken an absolute hammering, you know, through lockdown and everything that's happened there. These poor little brains trying to make sense of what adult brains can't make sense of.
I thought it was a brilliant insight to target children so young. So I remember being at primary school and not having a fantastic time. And yet a lot of your misery at that age isn't taken seriously because you're a little kid. You're supposed to be running around, you know, with a hoop. It's supposed to get me a source of joy and happiness. And I wasn't that guy.
No, but what I also think is really important is that kids understand that it's okay to be sad. And I think there's a massively scary figure, right? I get this. Since 2015, there's been a 40% increase in the amount of children aged between 8 and 12 who are given antidepressants. Now, just think about that. Rather than getting them to try and talk about their problems, deal with their problems, have a helping hand and an ear, they're being put on drugs. They're being put on antidepressants at 8 years old. Now, that is an absolute crime. So the more we can do to get them thinking about their own emotions and reaching out for support from things like Childline if they need it, but also just talking to a trusted adult or, you know, a friend and working through their problems and working out what is good sad and bad sad, then the more we can keep them away from the doctors who haven't got time to get them, you know, through mental health counselling or whatever it is, you know, and just prescribe them drugs. I mean, that whatever we can do for that and whatever I can do to help that has got to be a massive priority.
Well, it's great to hear you talk about these things and talk about so many things that that really people don't talk about. You have some very good messages in there. Just as we get to kind of the end, just a couple of questions. One, I mean, you know, it's so important, isn't it, for men to get checked out when they feel these things. What's the easiest way of driving this message home, do you think?
Just saying, just think what it would be like if you were dead tomorrow. You know, what you would regret looking down. Let's imagine there's a moment when you're there going, you're looking down going, oh crap, now I can't do this and this. And I got to a place where I could have died. So I assessed what that meant. But why not take yourself to that place before you have a crisis and go, okay, let's just imagine I've almost died. What would I do differently? So before that, and what is there for, is it worth doing to make sure I don't get to that place? Is it worth being more aware of my health? Is it being more healthy in terms of what I eat? Is it changing my work-life balance? Is it being aware that if I've got chest pains, that I need to get myself to A&E pretty darn quick? And then, so don't let yourself get into a crisis before you take preventative action.
Do you think much of it is to do with a fear of awkwardness? I've had an intimate examination up there as part of a brilliant NHS screening program, which I really applaud them for. But when I was with the team, they said a lot of people just don't show up. So you've got a room with like five people in and loads of equipment, and the people just don't come, which costs them a fortune.
I know. But we all don't like it. Imagine if you're a celebrity, right? So I'm there. I'm having a prostate exam, right? So I went with the doctor. and I turned up, nightmare of nightmares, it's a fill-in doctor who I don't know, okay? So I'm lying on the bed, and this is a true story. She's got her finger up my bum, and she says, "You are that bloke off the telly, aren't you? Whatever happened to that nice couple from Altrincham who bought that semi-detached house?" As she's got her finger up my bum. So all I would say is, anybody listening, it can't be as bad as that.
It can't be as worse. That's, yeah, absolutely.
That's the best public health message I've ever heard in my life. Yeah.
This should be, I mean, that should be the advert. The advert that that will inspire men to go to the doctor and traumatise children forever. Just as we get to the end, we always ask this. Let's say that in Warrington, where you were born, they've decided they're going to erect a giant Martin Roberts statue. It is going to be perhaps golden. It will be 300 feet in the air. And you get the chance to talk to the sculptor and tell them what to concentrate on or what they can change. What will you be creating? What will be the Martin Roberts statue?
Just a statue that when you look at it, it makes people smile.
Yeah. Nice. Well, it will. I will. I'll tell you what would make it smile. You could be lying prostrate, and there could be a doctor with a finger. I think that would
insert finger here.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. An interactive one, even better.
Asking whether she should have an extension built.
Yes. Listen, we've been very cruel to you, Martin, because you are out and about, you are filming, and we're making you not only shout about Lidl, but also shout very personal stories about your own anus in front of strangers. So we will let you go with our huge thanks, Martin. Thank you so much for being on Manatomy.
Thanks. Yeah, that's brilliant.
Keep up the good work.
Well, we caught him out and about, didn't we? But it felt like one of those conversations we had to have now, because he's just been through this incredible sort of trauma that's left him wiser, I think.
Yeah, and he had lots he needed to tell the world, and I think it came across with all the urgency and the freshness that someone who's just been through that would bring to it. It's very hard to recreate that, isn't it? And there's so many kind of tedious public health messages that just don't get through, and I think there's going to be so many men out there that can listen to his experience, and it's going to drop on them in a completely fresh way, and frankly, the way it's just dropped on me.
Yeah, I mean, it's the first time we've done a podcast that felt more like a news report at times. Do you know what I mean? With Martin out and about somewhere in the West End of London. But again, it was just that urgency. He's got these things that he just really wants to say. And one of them is, if you are feeling off, if there are signs that something might be wrong, don't be embarrassed. Don't feel awkward about it. Get it checked out. And that really came through when he was talking about his friend Dave as well.
Oh, God, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's so affecting, especially as he and I are exact contemporaries, actually. And it brings it home to you that you've got all these forward-facing plans and that they're not necessarily in your power. And there's no guarantee you get to the 80 that we're all aspiring to. And you can, even talking about that, and he's obviously come to terms with it so well, the emotion is in the back of his voice.
No, absolutely. And that, combined with you know, the bravery he had, you know, considering that he'd had these issues when he was a kid, of taking off his clothes on telly, basically, surrounded by, you know, as he said, his worst nightmare, the fact that they were all kind of like pop stars, Chippendales and reality stars, and feeling a bit shortchanged by that. Do you know what I mean? That was, you know, even at 58, those feelings don't go away.
Yeah, and it was great that he was open about those feelings as well, because it'd be so easy to go, I loved it. I just laughed it all off. I'm surrounded by these guys with ripped six-pack. But he doesn't say that, does he? He's one of those men who's really honest and is able to address feelings like that whilst being very much a regular guy, isn't he? He's not someone you look at him and think, oh, there's someone who has a slim volume of poetry always about his person. But he talks about feelings with such articulacy. It's very inspiring.
Yeah, so we thought that would be a great conversation to have on this, our 52nd episode with Martin Roberts, rounding off year one of Manatomy. And if you are new to the show, well, there are things you'll have missed, you know. If you've just joined in today, you're a Roberts fan, go back and have a listen. In fact, we have put together a few clips for you of shows that you may have missed, topics you may not be aware we have covered. And we thought it'd be a nice little moment just to look back, didn't we, Phil?
Oh, it's been an incredible journey. I don't know where you were on it, but I don't think I was expecting to have been quite on the emotional roller coaster. It's one of those things where you, I come away from each one and I run to the nearest family member and I kind of offload at them. They're now, they avoid me now. They're usually the doors are closed at this stage. But in the days when they would listen to me, it's so funny at times and then so emotional at other times. What has it been for you?
Yeah, no, same. You know, you have those shows where you're like, oh, wow, I had no idea it was going to go there. And other shows where literally our job was just to sit there and laugh. And both are valid and both are wonderful. So here is a little look back at some selected highlights from the past year. First up, former NBA star and business psychologist John Amici. What would me and Phil feel if suddenly we were in your body and we went outside for the first time?
You would have an incredible sense of personal vigilance. You would be aware of everyone around you. I am aware of everyone around me at all times. And that's not just because people tend to be concerned about my presence, but because I know that I can do harm to others if I'm careless. You know, if I turn too quickly, if I round a corner, I almost have radar when it comes to corners. I can tell if there's someone coming around the corner and I can stop. And I know that I can't even just stop and stand there. I have to move. Otherwise, if you come straight to me, I mean, I've had people drop their pumpkin spice latte recently right in front of me. And it's like, it's not an intent of mine, but it's just if I'm not super careful. So the vigilance would hit you. I think the sense of curating your face to make sure that you, because we all have that neutral face when we're just, you know, walking along and thinking. But that neutral face can often be the resting bitch face is what happens. And I believe that I probably have that if I'm not really careful. So I have a kind of, I don't know if it's a good smile, but a curated kind of warm smile that hits. And then the disappointment of having people look at you and be scared, which is always annoying. I'm not even trying to blame anybody individually, but it's just annoying because I'm not that. And the assumption of it is frustrating. But there's nothing you can do about that. That's the other part, right? That's the impotence of your size would hit you all of a sudden, realizing that with all this power, you can do nothing with it. You can never shout. You can never shout. You can never use your physicality except to defend someone else. And even then you put yourself at risk. It's a really remarkable thing to have all this and never be able to use it.
Next, we have an extraordinary performer and queer artist, Scotty. What did you make of the, I don't know if you had any involvement with the sort of gay culture, because I used to train in a gay-owned gym, gay-run gym in central London, and I've never met a group of men who work so hard to look so muscular, and there seemed to be a very powerful aesthetic that was dominant for them.
But again, that comes out of AIDS and HIV. So because of body wasting, facial and muscle wastage, the response to trying to look like you didn't have it was this muscle culture, which now straight men have adopted as being the key aesthetic. I must say, however, though, that created a culture for me that when I was 18, I'd never experienced verbal abuse like it, because I used to work in nightclubs, and quite often I'll tell people this thing and they're just like, what do you mean? And I was like, no, just take it for what it is. On two separate occasions in two separate nightclubs in my early 20s, somebody with a very muscled physiqued body, two different people, two complete separate incidences, tried to set me on fire.
What?
Just, you know, because I would always wear these like big sort of DIY sort of paper looks with my big fat tits hanging out and like my rolls hanging out. And they were off their head on both occasions, these two different people. But they did try to set me on fire. And luckily on both occasions, like I had friends nearby, or my friends who run the club were able to get their security to get people, those people and that group of people out. But, you know, there's also a really formative experience of being outside this sort of 24-hour cafe that's in Old Compton Street in London, waiting to get breakfast at 4 a.m. and being, you know, very young and having this group of gay elders, I guess I would have called them at the time, you know, they're in their 40s, lots of capital, waiting to get into this bougie cafe, turning around and collectively ripping into me. And that made me very quickly realize within that culture, because again, I pose a threat to them, because the thing is just because you're a gay man, it doesn't mean that you're not a man. Like, mm-hmm. you still have got the bullshit from masculinity with you. You just say it in a different way and you just articulate yourself in a different way.
It was great to sit down with the legendary late night radio host and TV host, Ian Lee.
I was... it's messy, right?
Yeah.
When I was 14 years old, I would go to public toilets and have sex with men, much older men in their 50s and 60s. And I had a lot of shame around that. And kind of continued sort of very secretly doing sexy things with guys as I got older. And it was only very recently I was able to share this with a therapist. And he said, okay, so you were abused. I said, no. I went there. He said, and you were abused. I said, no. I made the decision to go there. And he said, what did it do for you? I said, well, I felt afraid and I felt ashamed and I felt controlled and I was looking for love. He said, right. And you were 14. I said, yeah. He said, well, that was abuse. And it's only in the last few years I've been able to go, oh, shit. These men in their 50s and 60s. I was a 14-year-old kid. I know, you know, through family and friends, I know 14-year-old kids and they're kids. And I was a kid and I thought I was a man. And I didn't enjoy it, you know, apart from the orgasm, which is, you know, but I didn't enjoy it, hated it, didn't tell anyone about it. It was this big kind of secret I carried around with me. And I'm not saying that that made me bi. I guess I was. And you know, it was, I tell you why I did it. I did it for two reasons. One, because my dad was shit and he'd left and I wanted my dad back. Mm. And the other reason I did it, and again, I'm not suggesting for a second, because some people get confused when I say this. I'm not suggesting for a second what I'm about to say is what made me bisexual. This happened and is when I was 8, I was abused at the Cubs by an older man specifically. So I can look back now at that stuff at 14 and see it somehow trying to recreate my dad, get love from my dad, and take control, that thing again of taking control of what happened to me when I was 8. I don't know what I was doing, but I was looking for love in all the wrong places, basically. And I'd never told anyone about this. I'd mentioned it to a couple of therapists, but kind of played it down. And then a few years ago, I went and saw a great therapist, a guy called Chip Summers. He's brilliant.
Oh, yeah.
He's genius.
Yeah.
He's great. And I don't quite know how we got round to it, but it was a lot of talk about shame and stuff. And I mentioned the stuff I'd done with men. And he said, why don't we explore the idea that you might be bisexual? I'm not saying you are, but let's explore it. And it dawned on me that I was, you know, I texted a friend and said, oh man, I'm in big trouble. And she said, what is it? And I said, it's more sex stuff. She said, right. Is it kids? I went, no. She said, is it like, you know, have you bullied someone? I said, no. She said, is it gay stuff? I went, yeah. She went, oh, okay. Sorry you had to keep that a secret. And that was it. Mm-hmm. Sorry you had to keep that a secret.
The inspiring, internationally famous body campaigner, Jameela Jamil. Unbelievable company. Check this out.
There are some things that people can change about themselves if they are of that mindset, if they've kind of been brainwashed that they have to. Mm-hmm. Little things, you know, like hair color or hair transplants.
There are operations even for these things.
Plastic surgery and stuff like that. But there are some things that they obviously can't change. And one of them would be height, which I think for a lot of guys is a real issue and a very sensitive thing. So where are you on this sort of heightism?
I just can't bear it. I mean, I remember my character in The Good Place having to make some jokes about a shorter man and her not really wanting to date him and being bothered by his height. And the only way I could justify saying those things out loud is because my character is in hell. And that's why she's gone to hell, because she's such a shallow asshole. So we weren't in any way like condoning or glorifying it, but it still made me feel icky and weird even to this day. For me personally, I'm a very tall woman and no one kissed me until I was 21. partially because a lot of men were smaller than me and either didn't fancy me because I was taller or made them feel emasculated, which is programming, not biology, or they were worried that I wouldn't fancy them because of how unbelievably heightist so many women are, just openly on dating sites. So I look over at my friends, you know, like apps, and see that there are women saying no one under 6 feet. What a fucking preposterous way to look at other human beings. It's so disgraceful. And I personally love a shorter man. I also love a chubby man. I prefer a chubby man to a very thin and toned man. The fantasy that's being sold to men is not actually one that really fits with what a lot of women want. We really just want someone who's just not an asshole, I think, and is quite funny as a base. But these body ideals, I don't know who they're for, because they're sure as shit not for me. I don't care how tall someone is, but I think it's really disgusting that stigma has been put on men.
It's a massive deal. My wife is, I'm about 5'7", and my wife's 6'1". We've been together for 30 years.
Love that.
We're largely invisible now because we're old, but when we walked around as young people, people would laugh at us in the street as we're walking together. And
seriously?
And it was definitely, and it was uncomfortable.
And how did that make you feel?
Terrible. Absolutely terrible, actually. And you laugh it off, but somewhere inside you, if I could take a pill and wake up 6'4" tomorrow, I would take that pill.
I'm so sorry.
Has that stayed with you then, Phil? Is that kind of, you know, is that something that, because, you know, we talk often and, you know, in developing this podcast idea as well about the things that, you know, we're concerned about, or, you know.
Well, he didn't tell you that, Danny, so you can't be that close. Phil obviously feels closer to me. So yeah. I think we've established that.
Comedian Marcus Brigstocke was one of our earliest guests on the show, and so articulate when talking all things body.
My understanding of what happened is that I created in my mind a very unhelpful link between food and approval and food and love, which actually, I mean, everyone has the food love thing because breastfeeding and then weaning and then eat it up for mummy and aren't you a good boy? And if you finish that, then you can have pudding. And if you don't finish that, then you can't have pudding. And by the way, pudding is a treat. Mm-hmm. And so's this that I'd made for ages. You know, the associations are really strong, which most people grow out of. But if you have disordered eating, as I still do, those links go in and cement themselves. And then, of course, if you start to become unhappy about your body, which I don't need to tell you because here we are on this podcast doing this, your body is not just sort of what you live in. It's what you live in and literally who you are. Yourself goes up to the edges of your body, and for people with a spiritual belief, beyond there as well. But your physical self is all of, sorry, this seems very obvious as I say it, but it's all of what you are. So if your body is a source of pain to you and embarrassment and discomfort, physical and emotional, there's sort of nowhere to go with that. And so it's so mad to people, I think, who don't have these issues, but you're overweight, so you comfort eat. I mean, that is the definition of insanity. You know, the answer to being overweight is to eat less and exercise more, balance the calories in, calories out. But when your source of comfort is food, when food is the thing that says, you're okay, you're loved, we've got you, then it's where you go. And even like the worst thing about all of that, I think, was that I would regularly make commitments to other people about changing and all of that. But it's the promises you make to yourself, which I would do literally every night. I would lie in bed and I'd go, okay, well, that's it now. I'm glad today was as bad as it was. Like today I stole food from my best friend. I stole money from someone to get food. I ate from a bin because someone had sort of scraped some food onto the top of the bin. And I thought, well, it's not in the bin, so it's sort of all right. And I also broke the promise I made that was like this one last night. But that is it now. Like now that's it. Now I'm done. And then, of course, you wake up the next day and you've got the same toolkit you had the day before. You don't have any new powers. And the will is strong sometimes, but it's not enough. It might get you through a smaller breakfast, but no further than that until you get the help you need.
Stephanie Hirst, broadcaster extraordinaire, radio obsessive, and someone with a very, very fascinating story. Listen to this.
I pulled into the GP surgery, walked in, made an appointment, and because it wasn't an emergency appointment, you had to wait a week or so, or 2 weeks, and eventually did, turn back up. I think the appointment was at 3:30 or something. I was so tired from doing breakfast, I had a nap in the car before I went in. to impart this life-changing news to my GP who was going to set me on the pathway to changing my life. I had a little nap beforehand. I think I was just exhausted from it, guys. I think I just got to a point where I was just...
Well, sometimes
just,
you know that something is going to be big, you know, as well, yeah, a big moment, yeah. And your body, I don't know, you know, I often find I get very tired before a thing I know I'm going to do, and it's your body's way of, you know, preserving that energy. So maybe you knew that this was a huge moment for you and one you needed to do, and your body just went, I'm just shutting down for 5 minutes to deal with this. Yeah.
And I went to see my GP, and she's since retired, and she was incredible. And she just says, oh, you're not the first in our village. I'm like, am I not? And the thing is, I don't regard myself as trans. I have a trans history, but I don't label myself. So I don't like to label anybody else. There's lots of people who have got a trans history around us. You just don't see them.
And to finish, a slightly horrifying tale in some ways from one of our younger guests, the comedian Rhys James.
The way that I found out the kidney was messed up was slightly more dramatic, which is, the first time I noticed an issue with it is just a pain, a big dramatic pain, serious pain in my side. But I was staying over at a friend's house because my parents had gone to a James Taylor concert. And I, as they did more often than you'd think. And then I was at a friend's house and staying over. And then like there was just like a party going on downstairs. And I was just in bed up there in agony. And they're trying to get hold of my parents. His parents trying to get hold of my parents who are at a James Taylor concert who aren't answering. Whereas I'm like in agony in the bed. And then I pissed blood.
Oh.
And it was like, oh, well, this is an issue, isn't it? And I was like, yeah, while my parents ignore me, just going, oh, I've seen fire and I've seen rain. Well, I've seen blood coming out my dick. So who's got the bigger song to sing here? Let's get home, shall we, and sort this out. And then for a couple of months, I went to doctors about it. And doctors were like, oh, it's just growing pains.
What?
I was like, sorry, but how much can you be growing that you're pissing blood? I mean, how fast? How rapid? Also, bear in mind, I wasn't growing. I was fucking tiny. So I was like, there's no growing to be painful over.
And there you go. So there's loads on there. Other highlights. My goodness me. Jason Byrne talking about eye tests. Johnny Vaughan inventing Radio 4 panel shows before our very eyes. Reverend Richard Coles talking about the very unusual summer in 1976 where he discovered something he didn't know his body could do. It's all there for you. Go back and check them out. Till next time, me and Phil. Bye-bye.